ABH is pleased to present the memoirs of Tilly Aston, Australia's blind poet, author and philanthropist. The story told of the many faceted life of this talented woman is intriguing. The memoirs of Tilly Aston is published by Hawthorne Press and read by Pamela Adams. Episode 18. Concluding the memoirs of Tilly Aston. Philosophical. Through the highlights of my story, the reader has been led by this record, and if he has held his way from page to page, he will know that I have had my share of shadows, and likewise a goodly portion of very happy days. Now that the record is about to close, I feel moved to speak briefly of some of the guiding principles which have been the motive force of many, if not most, of my activities. Some years ago, I was brought into contact with a young chemist who, through an accident in the laboratory, had become totally blind. He was anxious to win the battle over his handicap, and we had many conversations about the matter. One day he asked me to write down for him some guiding rules which I considered to have aided me in what he thought a successful career. He was surprised to learn that up to that time I had never formulated any specific rules for my conduct, but had just gone along practicing the ideals and principles gathered subconsciously through the years. He set me thinking, and I soon realized that I was, in fact, led always by certain ideals, even though they might be overshadowed at times by human frailty or uncontrollable circumstances. When I tried to analyze what had motivated my behavior, I became aware that everything originated in the knowledge that the best, the only way of life, was to follow the teaching of the Divine Master, Jesus Christ. From childhood I had striven to know his precepts and to measure all things by the pattern of his love. My parents had been religious in the true sense, and without any lapse into sanctimoniousness, they had insisted on church-going, on rigid conformity to the commandments, and upon the Christian practice of the Golden Rule. Thus their children, including myself, grew up in the somewhat Puritan tenets of John Wesley. With such a background, it was easy to gather a permanent store of texts from Scripture, handy bits of wisdom so convenient as lamps on the troubled pathway of aspiration to higher planes. Here the native qualities of my mother had their own weight. She and father, too, had no education in the ordinary acceptance of the word. They knew nothing of schools and colleges. Father had learnt to read and write in his boyhood from his mother, who had those accomplishments. But his wife acquired a knowledge of reading at the Baptist Sunday School in Coleford, Gloucestershire. The use of the pen was not hers until the time when her lover was obliged to absent himself for a time in another town, and then she taught herself to write from copybooks, so that she might be spared the necessity of calling in a third person as a scribe for her love letters, as was stated earlier in this story. Now, in those days, copybooks were liberally adorned with mottos, maxims, text and proverb, culled from Solomon, Aesop, Isaac Watts, and the Book of Wisdom that belongs to the common people of every nation. Mother had a mind stored with those sayings, and as far as I can remember, there was something appropriate to well-nigh every occasion. If we lifted our voices in complaint, out would come, "A cheerful spirit goes on quick, while grumblers in the mud will stick." Let us indulge in a bit of backbiting, or in a trifle of gossip or scandal, and we would be admonished with, "Premeditate your speech. Words once flown are in the hearer's power and not your own." How often came the warnings, "A stitch in time saves nine," or "Waste not, want not." And our bathing was solaced by the statement that cleanliness is next to godliness. Perhaps in these sophisticated times we laugh at such teachings, but after all, it was good, and better still, it stayed in the memory. Often would our parents entertain us with the poems and songs of Dr. Watts to stimulate industry, thrift, and family unity, and to warn us of vanity, selfishness, and against lapses from filial piety. At this distance of time, I can hear Mother reciting, "'Tis the voice of the sluggard," or, How doth the little busy bee? Birds in their nests agree. 'Tis dog's delight to bark and bite. And many, many more. Indeed, I love those odd old rhymes, even if I laugh at them now. With the lapse of time and the fuller realization of my handicap, it was borne in upon me that I needed some additional philosophy which might be applied to my own personal problems, and which was not to be found in mother's maxims and rhymes, nor in the verses of the old schoolmaster Dr. Watts. First, as a spirit of independence asserted itself very early, I was determined not to let other people do for me, because of my blindness. Anything that I could do, I did for myself. Applied to all the trifling daily offices of my life, this has been the very key to self-help. Of course, kind hearts in the breasts of kindred and friends always prompts them to offer the aid they think is needed. But for the sightless, not otherwise afflicted in health, it is their very salvation and happiness to let them do all they can for themselves, giving play to every faculty of the body, and to every inward resource so necessary for the development of the human soul. By the persistent practice of this rule, I have been able to win such independence as I possess. Next in importance has been my resistance to discouragement. How often it has been said to me, "You can't do this," or "You can't do that." More than once a sighted acquaintance has been offended when I protested, "How do you know I can't? You have no right to say I can't until I have tried and failed." Thus I have pursued my way, attempting everything that I thought worthwhile, disregarding the gloomy predictions of sympathetic but unpractical advisers. Failures have come to me, and from them I have learned lessons, but the will to do things has tested my capacity to the full and saved me from many disappointments I might have otherwise had. It must be confessed that I have never admitted an inferiority complex, save in one aspect, which was shown in the constant desire to excel as a woman, in spite of my handicap, since I knew that to overcome I must use more of myself than a seeing person to attain to equal power and status. Always I resented any attempt on the part of others to lower my crest, for I regard it as the part of weaklings and lazy folk to lean on others and accept unchallenged the patronage of less understanding people. To become self-helpful and at the same time fitted to render service, I convinced myself that God helps him who helps himself. Another of Mother's maxims. As a rule, her maternal instinct was with me in my strivings for growth and independence. Only on rare occasions did she resort to the "you can't do it" method of obstructing my enterprise or ambition. Although my chief interests had been among blind schoolmates and friends, I was not slow to test my powers in the company of those who see. I entered for competitions, joined literary clubs, and made companions of fully endowed women, enjoying the effort to keep pace with them in their adventures. This kind of free intercourse with the ordinary world made an appreciable contribution to my progress. Any condition approaching segregation tends to limit the horizons, no less in the realms of the mental than the physical. Hence I felt I must not depend on my fellows in the dark for moulding my outlook on life, for stimulus towards attainment, and for a true estimate of my own abilities, to range my wits against the ordinary thinker, to exchange ideas and opinions with those of wider opportunities. This was indeed a liberal education. Briefly, I aimed at reducing the impression of singularity to the minimum, and I believe that in so doing lay wisdom. In order to pursue this policy, I had to check down on touchiness and to cultivate a lively sense of humor. Such repression was useful, for it gave me self-control and serenity of poise in many embarrassing circumstances to come from time to time. So I was always glad to widen my circle, gaining for my own many lovely possessions which could have come to me in no other way. As I have grown older, like most sane people, I have become aware of the steadying down of the fires of purpose. Judgment is calmer, enthusiasm more reasonable, and often censoriousness is softened and sweetened. Perhaps this is due to the knowledge that ultimate issues of the things we do and the thoughts we cherish are never laid bare at once. With the temperament of an individualist and with convictions always clearly defined, I suppose it is natural that I should have encountered opposition and been forced to fight my way through many troubles and obstacles. At the time, these battles were grievous and odious to the taste, until they were far enough behind me to be seen in their true perspective. Then, in calmer mood, with the edges and stings blunted by time, I have been able to recognize the truth that in the hands of God, even the evil can be made to work for good. Therefore, as I close this story, I am happy to sum up my faith in those words of Holy Writ, "All things work together for good to them that love God." And we finish with a final poem from Tilly, The Search. Ever I sought for God to find him near, since the dim, moulding days of infancy, when parents read the words of Holy Seer, and spoke of God with faith and constancy. 'Twas then I knew him as a father kind, and gently loving as a mother's kiss, and walked confiding by the black abyss, where death and sickness howl like arctic wind. Then came the rousing days of ardent youth, when I, a conscript, must arise and fight all that opposed fair dealing, love, and truth. But who should lead me in the path of light? A man of God cried, "See your standard borne," and forth to battle went I in the train of him who shall for endless aeons reign and lead through sorrow to eternal morn. But oft the soldier wearies in the field, and vision dwindles to the trodden ways. Hopes broken, stubborn foes that will not yield, and raining tears make dim the heavy days. And yearning still I seek the forest nave, or ocean strand, where I may drink the breeze, and find him glorious walking mid the trees, or spirit bright upon the flaming wave. A gracious hour when to my home I haste, and sit before my hearth to rest and dream, repairing all the bitter conflict's waste in a calm shallow of life's racing stream. No need to seek for God, for he is here, and all-pervading like the balm of sleep, a tender presence, fraught with comfort deep, close to my soul, as to my lips the air. And that brings us to the end of the memoirs of Tilly Aston, Australia's blind poet and philanthropist. This is Pam Adams thanking you for listening and appreciating the many faceted life of this talented woman.
And that brings us to the end of episode 18 and the conclusion of The Memoirs of Tilly Aston, published by Hawthorne Press and read by Pam Adams. The series was produced in the studios of 3RPH Melbourne for the RPH Network.
We here at 3RPH hope you have enjoyed the story of Tilly Aston. Now I would like to read some passages from Seeds of Compassion, the story of the Association for the Blind by Kathleen L. Shepherdson, which was written in 1972. Life is not so much what each individual makes it, but rather what we make of it for each other. These words of Helen Keller, the most famous blind woman of the 20th century, might well have been the motivating force behind the life of Miss Tilly Aston, who founded the Association for the Advancement of the Blind, now known more simply as the Association for the Blind. Miss Aston was in her teens in the 1890s. Many a teenager today feels as she felt then, harassed on all sides by anomalies and inequalities. There the similarity ends. Today's teenagers have discovered the power of the group. Miss Aston knew only that the blind man was a unit, powerless to make his wants known. In her various writings, she pictures the extreme isolation suffered by many blind people. They were like birds in a cage, and even neighbours were scarcely aware of their existence. Relatives had a sneaking shame at being burdened with such a family disability. Many blind people had no say in their own affairs or even in the clothes they wore, and often they were treated as deaf as well as blind and spoken to through a third person. For those who went blind after school leaving age, there was no way of earning a living and no pension. And the Victorian Yearbook listed 1,097 blind people in this state at the time, only 5% of whom went blind in childhood. So isolation, dependency and unsatisfied longings were the lot of the vast majority. Even the more advantaged, those who had attended the Asylum and School for the Blind, now the Royal Victorian Institute for the Blind, and could find employment in its factory, were only a little better off. They lived mainly on the premises and were shut off from every means of self-improvement and self-expression, and from any chance of mingling with ordinary citizens on an equal footing. There were few books in Braille or Moon, and unless one had been to the asylum school, there were few opportunities to learn to read by touch anyway. Miss Aston herself was forced to relinquish her arts course in its second year for lack of material in Braille. This spurred her on later to found the Braille Writers Association of Victoria, now the Braille Library of Victoria, but that is a different story. There were restrictions on travel, and it was very costly. A blind person had to be prepared to pay two fares, for himself and his guide, or stay at home. Travel interstate was virtually prohibited. Blind people were prisoners of a bond system. Shipping companies demanded a bond of £400 before they would carry a blind passenger. This was to protect the states against an influx of people likely to become a burden on public or private charity. It operated very harshly against the blind in interstate journeys. As Miss Aston says, even a short holiday visit was denied the sightless traveller, and often he was subjected to a humiliating scene with the immigration officials when attempting a little jaunt. Let us try to understand what this irksome bond system involved by seeking to bring it up to date. The Commonwealth statistician told me that in the values of those days, £400 was equivalent to 7 times the average yearly wage. The last Commonwealth yearbook, 1970, shows that the average male wage for a week was $69. Convert this to a year and multiply by 7, and you get a figure more than $25,000. How would you like to pay this sum before you went to visit a cousin in Tasmania or had a holiday on the Gold Coast? No wonder the blind people hated the bond system. Who today is robbed of a vote? In the 1890s, only those blind people who could sign their name with a pen were permitted to vote. The rest were disenfranchised. Today, there is an ever-growing number of welfare agencies, and the problem is to coordinate them to stop overlapping. Then, despite the desperate plight of the blind, there was only the asylum and school and one other small group, the Mission to the Outdoor Blind. They employed a blind Cornish miner, Mr. James, to visit country areas and instruct pupils in their own homes the rudiments of Braille or Moon. Miss Thorne's treat was the one social occasion of the year. It was usually held in a hall at the top end of Collins Street, organised by Miss Thorne, who ran a private school in South Yarra. It gave the known blind of Melbourne one opportunity to meet and mix, to enjoy tea together, and then listen to a concert. Such was the dry, arid soil of the times before Miss Aston began moving among her fellow blind, stirring them up, arousing them out of apathy, implanting concern for others, and generally preparing the soil for the tiny seeds of action. She was only 21 when she, a totally blind girl, and 7 other blind people of varying ages, by this time on fire with compassion, sowed the seeds of what has grown into a modern, progressive welfare agency for the blind, with a staff around 200 and assets nearing $1.5 million. The tiny seeds of action have their sowing. Tilly Aston's Songs of Light. As might have been expected, the formation of the Association of Braille Writers in 1894 led to a re-emphasis of the needs of the blind and focused attention on the isolation of sightless people. The young society was producing books for the blind, but where were the people to read them? Of the number listed in the yearbook, just on 1100, the blind people themselves knew the whereabouts of only about 1/4. At this time, Miss Aston was living in Nicholson Street, South Yarra, trying to establish herself as a teacher of singing and music. Former friends of school days would drop in for a cup of tea and a yarn about things in general. This small group became increasingly concerned for others of their class, to quote Miss Aston. They wanted to find the isolated ones, those who left the school, went into obscurity, and never emerged again. They were unhappy about the problems posed by the blind who begged on the streets or went from door to door. They particularly wanted to help the newly afflicted who knew not where to turn. But above all, they wanted to run their own lives in a normal, civilized manner. "We talked it over. Oh, how we talked," said Miss Aston in an address 40 years later, the 17th of October, 1935. And finally, there began to evolve some definite suggestions. Eventually, those at these informal meetings in Miss Aston's home agreed action was necessary. They promised to stand behind her if she would try to get the blind people together and form them into some sort of organization to improve things. The inauguration. 40 invitations were sent out for a meeting on the 7th of December, 1895. This was too many to be comfortably accommodated in the Aston parlour, so a blind friend, David Blakely, who lived in Faulkner Street, South Yarra, offered his home. Did the stout hearts quail when only 8 blind people turned up? Or did this only act as a spur to goad them into action? Did the lack of numbers serve but to increase the determination they felt to do something for the others? We don't know, but we do know that they went ahead as planned. A simple, broad constitution was drafted. Those present became foundation members of an association for the advancement of the blind. They each paid 1 shilling entrance fee and set about appointing each other to office. Mr. Dave Robertson, a man who ran his own business weaving baskets for demijohns, etc., became the first president. Miss Aston was voted honorary secretary and treasurer and took charge of the first 8 shillings. There had been 2 other blind men, sympathetic to the objects of the new organisation, who were not present at that December meeting. So the nucleus was 10. Within 2 years, the numbers had swollen to 74. Membership increased steadily to 350 in 1920, and the high peak was reached in 1936, when it totaled 580. It was natural for there to be this steady growth. The organisation was fighting for the satisfaction of its united needs. Their own welfare and that of others proved a powerful lever. And the rest is history. My name is Tony Hall, and I have been reading from Seeds of Compassion, which was written by Kathleen L. Shepherdson and was written in 1972.